Happy to welcome back to the program from the Boston Globe, our friend Bob Ryan. Bob, good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon and Happy New Year.
Thank you. The same to you. You were scheduled to be on with us last week when the events of Wednesday occurred. Is it safe to say this is the kind of thing that we just haven't seen in our lifetime?
Yeah, it's quite safe to say. I mean, yes, there have been there was a breach of the House of Rep back in '54 with the Puerto Rican Nationalists shooting to join up, and we did have that. But in terms of internal domestic invasion of the Capitol, we know how unprecedented that was.
And this did not come in a vacuum, and these divisions and these extreme views in America, Bob, have been coming for a while. And I think at least part of this, and rather than blame the creators of this, I put a little of the blame on us, the consumers of media in this country. When I was a kid, I knew that when Walter Cronkite was doing the news, that was news. And when Eric Severide came on, that was commentary. How did people stop making that distinction?
Well, I know that that's a ongoing topic. I sort of reject that it's so universal or that it's that difficult to make the distinction. A relaxation of the norm, a relaxation of the code, if you will. I guess that would be the simple answer to your question there. How do we get to that? The thing that worries me the most about everything is that it doesn't matter whether the problems or the rhetoric is coming from the right or the left. People are sadly historically ignorant and don't realize that this is a young country, that it's only been officially minted since 1776. And if you study history, you'll see that there. It's not a long period of time, and number one, and that all dynasties have pretty much crumbled, whether they're Egyptian or Roman or the Ottoman Empire or whatever, and that people have been fed this idea that we're exceptional, American exceptionalism. No, there's no such thing. What I'm getting at, we have a fragile democracy, and people don't appreciate that things can change. And that we're not, and everything that we've known, that you and I knew, and all your listeners know, as we grew up, doesn't mean it's always going to be that way if we don't take steps to protect ourselves and protect this very important way of government that we have. And that's the real thing that worries me, that people think that, you know, I read a book many, many years ago, Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, and that had to do with an allied topic. It can happen here, and people have to understand that. I don't think most people have any remote idea what I'm talking about.
You tweeted about this last night, and I think we'd agree it would be a colossally bad and tone-deaf decision for Bill Belichick to go to the White House, given the time we're in right now, to accept a Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yes, I'm very upset. Now, am I shocked knowing that he had declared himself publicly to be a Trump supporter with a famous letter that was read by Trump at a rally a number of years ago? Am I shocked that Bob Kraft donated $1 million to the Trump inauguration and that the two of them are in lockstep, I guess, with this? No, but I think that you would like to think that you'd take a deep breath and step back and recognize that the appropriate atrocious timing of this is the number one issue here, and that maybe this isn't a good time to accept this offer under these horrible national circumstances. And I'm disappointed that Bill Belichick, who apparently has declared out of it, is prepared to accept this offer for this medal. The timing is just absolutely unacceptable. It's timing. It's horrible, and I just. I'm very upset about it, and I haven't. So I'm just hoping that there'll be common sense will prevail in the end. I'm not counting on it, but I'm hoping.
We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. Let's discuss college basketball. You are all in on the idea of all of the teams gathering in Indianapolis.
I am. If you're going to have it, then I'm not sure it's wise to even have it. All right, look at this is the most unimaginably truncated season with games being postponed, canceled, etc., all the time. But if you're going to do it, that Indiana is the place. The whole state is a basketball culture. They have the facilities between the universities and the facilities that are in Indianapolis. They have the interest. There was no place that would, if you're going to do it in this fashion, that's the place to do it. And because I've advocated they should just make the Final Four permanently home in Indianapolis. Not that I don't love New Orleans. Not that I don't think that San Antonio is also a very good site. But Indianapolis cannot be beaten for the package of everything that it offers for the tournament. And this is the perfect place. I hope they can pull it off.
Now, our producer, Kerry Haskell, who is a New Orleans homeowner, also endorses your idea, or at least your support of having the Super Bowl down there every year.
Yeah, I kidded long ago. I'm a New Orleans major fan. I kidded long ago that every major sporting event should be in New Orleans. They should have the Super Bowl there, the Final Four, the World Series, everything. The Stanley Cup, put it in New Orleans. They know how to run a party. It is a wonderful domestic one. It's my favorite domestic city to visit. But all kidding aside, the basketball belongs in Indiana. I think New Orleans would be a spectacularly perfect, and there wouldn't be too many objections if they were to make New Orleans this permanent home of the Super Bowl. It's not going to happen. People are going to, you know, bid for it, and they're going to want to move it around. But the fact is that New Orleans is the best place for the Super Bowl, and Indianapolis is the best place for the Final Four.
We have had such really heartbreaking losses in the Celtic family in the last several weeks here. Most recently, someone that I know you were very close to. Can you talk a little bit about Paul Westphal?
Paul Westphal was a very special person. We hit it off immediately when he joined the team in 1972. Could not help but become his friend. I'm not going to apologize for that in any way. And loved covering him. I loved knowing him. And he was as good a person as you would like to think that an athlete can be. A definite man of faith, there's no question, but he wasn't a proselytizer. He just lived his life in an exemplary manner, and it was a wonderful life as a Hall of Fame player, as a coach who went to an NBA Finals, as a college coach, and just as a good person. He did something last year at the Hall of Fame that I'm not sure that it was unprecedented, but the way he pulled it off was couldn't have been better, Rich. And that is that on the day after the ceremony, he had a brunch, and he had about 40 people that he had invited from all walks of his life, and we all had to sit at a certain table that, you know, and he walked around the room and explained why we were all there and why we had been invited. And it was people who were all parts of his life from grade school on that he owed a debt of thanks to and wanted to be remembered, and wanted to know how much he valued the relationship. And there were high school people and all different people from different walks of life. And there was a journalism table. Mike Lupik and myself and our wives were there. And it was so gracious and so articulate and so witty. He had stories to tell. It was a tour de force. It was I can't imagine that anyone has ever handled his Hall of Fame or her Hall of Fame ceremony any better than Paul and role there, other than Paul did that for his entourage.
We all knew about Casey Jones' skills as a player and a coach, but I was happy to see you on social media bring up another side that not everybody was aware of, but I remember it because 40-some years ago now, I think, I was in a softball tournament up in Fort Fairfield, and Casey was there for some reason, and I ended up seeing him blowing everybody away, singing in the lounge of the motel up there. And what a wonderful singing voice he possessed.
Fantastic voice. He came alive at that moment. He was a shy introvert for the most part, and very modest, and didn't call attention to himself in any way. Except when you put that microphone in his hand and gave him a podium and gave him an audience. And then, oh my God, and then he belted out, "You're Nobody, the Somebody Loves You." He belted out "Close to You." He had a whole repertoire. But I think his signature song was "You're Nobody, the Somebody Loves You." Yes, and those, you know, it was widely known in the basketball community that he did this, but obviously the public, unless they happened to be sitting there innocently at the bar or the lounge where he showed up, and they were treated to this, you know, wonderful thing of Casey Jones singing.
Major League Baseball trying to figure out what to do going forward, and discussion still going on about the length of the season, but also about some of the rules. And I'm curious what you think about some of the ideas that are being floated out there. Let's start with universal DH. Good idea or not?
Totally endorse it. I've railed for years that it's so ludicrous to have two different rules, because the only thing that separates the two leagues is the DH. They consolidated everything else, all the operations, all the umpires, all the thing. There's nothing else. There's no National League, American League president. There's only the commissioner, and there's no reason to have two separate sets of rules. And it is ridiculous when it gets to the playoff time, the World Series time. It's just stupid. I mean, to me, it was embarrassing that they would let this thing go on for 40 years. So they better do the universe. And they're not going to go the other way.
So right.
Do the DH. That's it. Period.
And I called it Ghost Runner going into last season because it reminded me of those days playing pickup baseball. If you didn't have enough players, you'd have a Ghost Runner. But this putting a man on second base in extra innings, I hated the notion of it, but then watching it play out, it wasn't as bad as I thought.
It met with surprising approval. It doesn't have my endorsement, but I know that I'm in the minority, and it looks like there's a lot of feeling that they want to keep it. I just didn't think it was that necessary. I really don't think that they talked about the length of the games. It seemed to me that there weren't all that many colossally long games. Most games go into extra innings end in the tenth. I think, but historically, and if not, then the 11th, and they don't go all every once in a while. Sure, you get an 18 inning game. I understand that, but not that often. I don't think it was necessary, but I do know that that's a minority. I'm not going to put up a big fuss about it. A lot of smart people like it, and maybe I have to come to learn to like it.
All right, let's see where we go on this one. The best late career album by Frank Sinatra. Now, I had some ideas of what I thought it was, and I recently discovered this album that he did with Gordon Jenkins very late in his career called She Shot Me Down.
Yeah, funny, because I was listening to Sinatra Channel and XM this afternoon, and he sang. It was from a concert in Vegas, and he was introducing the album. I got a new album, yeah, and it's got some old songs, but here's a new song, and it was from She Shot Me Down. Not my favorite of the late ones. I'd go more. Not that I'm, I don't think any of the late ones were on a par with his best stuff, but. L.A. Is My Lady, I would prefer personally to She Shot Me Down.
No, I also know, because
Quincy Jones.
Yeah, now I still think of That's Life as late career, but that was not quite at that level.
The great thing about these topics, there's no right and wrong. Picking the favorite Sinatra song is, for those who love him as I do as an artist, is impossible. To pick one or anything else, or even. But I do have a favorite album. We've talked about this. It's Sinatra at the Sands. I think it's the perfect Sinatra introduction. If you don't know what Sinatra's all about, you will know what he's all about when you listen to Sinatra at the Sands. The range of songs. And he's in perfect voice. He's 50 years old. His voice is intact. It's wonderful. He's got Count Basie behind him. They're great songs, great arrangements by Quincy Jones. I think, to me, that's the quintessential Sinatra, is Sinatra at the Sands.
And what's the best song, his best recorded piece of music?
Well, there isn't. I mean, I know what I like. I mean, I know, but I mean, I can't say that. You can't. If you're gonna pick one, because it's got to be with Gordon Jenkins. It's got to be with Nelson.
Nelson Riddle, yeah.
That's the pinnacle. It has to be. And so now you go with the Riddle stuff. And of course, I Got You Under My Skin is one of the most famous arrangements in the history of American popular music. So it's the perfect Riddle arrangement. It's the perfect sound voice. He's 1956. He's 41 years old. He's seasoned. His voice isn't perfect. I like that. I tell you, I like the up-tempo version. That this is another middle arrangement of All or Nothing at All. One of my handful of favorite pieces of music that I've ever heard. That's certainly one of them. But there are countless ones. But if you got to pick one that summarizes him at his absolute peak, you couldn't go wrong with I Got You Under My Skin.
Can't disagree with that at all. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, always a pleasure for us to talk with you, Bob. Thanks so much for being with us, and we wish you well. Stay safe, be well. We'll catch you soon.
Very good. Bye-bye.
Bob Ryan here on Downtown.